Hey, welcome to the Charlie Paparelli Show. Thanks for joining us. I've been an angel investor for over 30 years in the Southeast here, and during that time, I've met hundreds of entrepreneurs who have taught me how to start companies from scratch and to grow them into valuable enterprises. And this show is all about helping sharing what other entrepreneurs have done, or what other managers have done, and leaders have done in order to make you a more effective entrepreneur. My guest today, before I forget, you should subscribe at paparelli.com if you don't want to miss one of these episodes. And as a bonus, you'll get my Tuesday blog that goes out. My guest today is Horst Schulze. Horst is currently a senior consultant and resident customer experience expert for Arch and Tower Consulting here in Atlanta. He is the former CEO of what was then the newly created brand, Capella Hotels and Resorts. He's the former CEO of Ritz-Carlton Hotels. He actually built the Ritz-Carlton brand that we know today by building the culture from scratch. He is highly sought after speaker on excellence and customer experience. He is the author of Excellence Wins, which is this book here, which I just finished reading, and I want to tell you, it is excellent. He shares his core values and belief, as well as his secrets of success. I recommend the book highly for all entrepreneurs. You will be overwhelmed with the ideas that you come away with there to make your business better. I met Horst when he spoke for High Tech Ministries, which I was president and chairman, over 20 years ago. He shared with us his relationship with Jesus Christ and how this foundation set him on a course to lead and serve all his life. Horst single-handedly created a sea change in the high-end hotel industry, and we'll hear a lot about that today. So welcome, Horst, and thanks for agreeing to share your life and excellence with me and with my entrepreneurial audience.
And I'm delighted to be with you.
Oh, this is going to be a lot of fun. I've been so looking forward to this. In fact, I was a little nervous talking to such a great man as yourself. You have quite the legacy, my friend.
Oh, well. Yeah, that sounds really good. I let you introduce me always from now on, yeah?
Okay. It'll be my pleasure. I'll do it. But tell me, I was a little, this Arch and Tower, I was, what are you doing now? I was a little confused by that.
Well, nothing really. I'm just that I mentor those young people. I know them for a long time. They created a consulting company. I had an office in Buckhead. My secretary retired, and I was alone. And they said, "Why don't you move in with us? We happen to have space. We give you the space. You can share one of our secretaries as long as you mentor to us."
Oh, how wonderful!
So I'm an independent, I have an office with them, that's it. But I do mentor those young people, which I'm delighted to do because they're exceptional what they're doing.
Yeah, it's Fraser Dieter, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Is it Fraser and Dieter who?
Yeah. There is the vision of Fraser and Dieter, yes.
Okay. That's it. They're an amazing CPA firm, and you know what they've done and how many different businesses they've kind of gone into. Quite an influence.
That's it. They have this consulting arm, which is Arch and Tower. And those young people are just exceptional. And I have no good taste with consultants generally, even though I consult myself. But those young people, they do it right. And I'm happy to mentor them. And I join them in all their meetings and give them advice, if you will. Yeah, that's why they want me to be here. So I have a beautiful free office and a free assistant and everything.
Well, that's the way to go. That's the way to go. Well, you've earned it. You know, it's just to be associated with you increases their brand for sure. But, you know, it's funny you say, you know, this whole thing about talking about consultants, you know, like you said, I'm not crazy about consultants, but you realize as operators, and I was an operator for a long time, at some point as we get older, you know, people start looking at us as coach and consultants and we go, "Oh my God, I turned into one."
I did too.
So you have to be careful if you say you don't like consultants. It means you don't like yourself, okay?
Absolutely right. Yeah. That's exactly how it is, yeah.
One of the things that came up in your book, it really struck me, is right from the beginning, within the opening, you talked about how this idea when you were a child just sort of pops in your head that you are meant to be in the hotel business.
Yeah.
Can you talk just a little bit about that? And I'll share with you what I give when I give a speech, I mean, gave speeches in the past to entrepreneurs, how I kind of characterize what happened to you. But tell me about it. Tell me about that experience.
I cannot characterize it. We have a hard time. Emmanuel, I was only 11 years old. I grew up in a village in Germany. We had no hotels. I never was in a hotel. In fact, literally, I had never been in a restaurant before.
Oh, my gosh. And your father, he wasn't associated with that kind of business or anything?
No, not at all. He was a postman.
Okay.
I met him first when I was 7 years old because he came back from the war when I was seven.
Wow. Okay.
No, he was gone for years. He was in Russia for years, and then he came from prison camp when I was seven.
Okay.
And with 11, and he had no, I don't think he would have known what a hotel is.
Yeah. It's one thing. It's funny. He knows what his prison camp is, but he didn't know what a hotel was. I mean, that's it. Talks about those days of war. It's crazy.
Wow. It's just dramatic, you know. So I must have read something about a hotel or whatever. That's what my parents think, that probably I read something. I like to read a lot and stuff at that young, and I must have read something. So I went home with 11 and said, I want to work in the hotel business. They said, yeah. What does it mean when you're 11? But slowly, as I kept on insisting on it, first they tried to talk me out of it. That's embarrassing. That's not what you did in Germany after the war. You went into a technical shop. If I would have said, I want to be a roofer, yes, that's a good hands job. Mm-hmm. If I would have said engineer, now that is an honor, the highest you can have, or architect, technically meaning. But hotel business? So first they tried to talk me into it. Then they get embarrassed.
Well, when they tried to talk you out of it, here you are a young man. How come you weren't so allowed yourself to be influenced by your parents?
I cried. I begged. I could see something. I could see working in a fine hotel.
But you didn't even know what a hotel was.
No, I guess you
did have to read about it. You must have read some story about a fine hotel.
That's the only way possible.
Yeah.
So sooner or later, they inquired what to do in a government agency, career agency. And they said, well, if he starts very early, he should start in the law as a busboy, but make sure you start in a very good hotel.
Okay.
The next thing they inquired, what is the best hotel in the region? And then they inquired for a job there and got a job as a busboy in the best hotel in the region. Unfortunately, that was 100 kilometers away. And mind you, at that time, that was very far.
So your parents found this hotel friendly job for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I just tell a story on that just before you go to this next step, which you want to hear, is I talk to entrepreneurs sometimes. I give a talk on characteristics of successful entrepreneurs. And one of those is I ask the question to entrepreneurs, how many of you knew at a very early age, probably middle school, you know, sort of 10, 11, that you were going to be an entrepreneur? You might have not known that word, but you knew you were going to be in your own business. And I can't tell you how many hands go up.
Wow.
And so when I read in your book, what happened to you in the hotel about being a hotelier, I said, there it is again. And what I tell them is, you know, when a thought, there's no scientific explanation for where a thought comes from. None. So I claim, and I haven't had anybody tell me I'm wrong, that thoughts can only come from God. Dogs don't have thoughts, only humans.
That's my opinion. I'm very strongly so. Very strongly so. I have. If I would think different, I would be crazy based on my life following that. Because not only, if you look really at my situation, I'm basically an elementary school dropout.
Okay.
I left when I was 14, okay? now, from a small village, And the ultimate dream would have been maybe to be the maitre d' somewhere. Mm-hmm. Realistically, that would have been ultimate, nearly unreasonable dream, but a dream. But here I am, leaving and then leaving the country and leaving different country by myself, 14 years old in a dorm room, and go on and have a career where people hail me. I accept it, but as the number one hotelier in the world.
Yeah.
Now, if I would assume that was me, that would be the ultimate championship arrogance you could possibly find. Now, come on. I mean, anybody who thinks that would be...
Yeah, let's not forget where you're from, right? You know, come on. You can't do that.
Come on. And I'm very closely connected to the village. As in fact, I have a home there. Where my wife and I spend a lot of summers. To think that would be my background, that I could have accomplished what I accomplished on my own. But I believe that God is in that for some reason. I don't know why. I'm not saying God.
How many children do you feel? You know, you say to a child, what do you want to be? And they're, you know, I want to be a fireman. I want to be a policeman. I want to, right? Sure. You think of occupations you've seen. When you get called like you did, and then to stay on it, interested in it, okay, and become a leader in it, and be in it your entire life, only God can do that.
Only God can do that. Only
God can do that.
You know, come to think of, I mean, I asked my younger daughter when she was 11, asked her, so what do you want to do? I asked them all that in her life. And she said, I want to be a canine policewoman. I said, why? She said, well, I like dogs and I like to give orders. I said, your motives are not very well coming out of you. You have to look at different motives in your life, you know.
No, that's funny. So yeah. You started as, you said, a busboy, 100 kilometers away from home. So they put you in a dorm room. How old were you?
At that time, I was 14.
Oh, my gosh.
14.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. To be away from your parents and working like that's crazy. Okay, so what happened?
Yeah. Well, my life changed the first day I arrived in the hotel. First of all, I was told this is a hotel where we could never go, my parents. Now, this is only for very important ladies and gentlemen. Now, behave yourself and then all those things, of course, parents give you in your life. And the next thing is I meet the general manager of the hotel with my mother, and she took me there. And he says, now, the guests here are very important ladies and gentlemen. And they were. Mm-hmm. They were. But... you are only here to learn how to serve them. Don't become envious. You are not them. They are important and you are not. That's literally what he said.
Okay.
You are here to serve them. Next one I meet is the maitre d' of the hotel, the man in charge of food and beverage, whom I am reporting to. And he told me, and it changed my life. Right that moment, impacted my life dramatically. God put this man in front of me. And he said things that I didn't understand, but it impacted me. He said, now tomorrow, show up at 7:00. If I meant 1 minute after 7, I would say so. 7:00. And don't come to work. Come to be excellent in what you're doing. Now this went right over my head. Wait a minute. I know I have to wash dishes and clean floors and all those things. Excellence in what I'm doing. And it took me a long time to learn what he meant. And this man, he didn't do anything without very high intent. And I come to the conclusion over the years that excellence is not an accident. Excellence is always the result of high intent and hard work. And he said it right there. And he said it for himself. In everything he was doing, he had high intent and worked hard for it. And that's what he tried to give. And he said, never go to work. Go to work to create excellence in what you're doing. Create excellence for yourself.
This was Herr Carl Zeitler.
Carl Zeitler.
Right?
Same.
Yes. And yes. Tell me, it's interesting when we start in occupations like this, new occupations. Yeah. Again, I call this is a God moment too, where he puts a mentor in your life. Yeah. And this is someone you respect him, but you aspire to what he is.
Yeah.
You know? So how did you, as a young man, how did you then become a mentor of Herr Zeitler? You know, and how did it come about that he then adopted you, if you will? Did that ever happen? In other words, he chose to be your mentor as just more than your boss, if you will. He saw something in you, you know?
Yeah, but he was a tough mentor. he set standards, and he was the owner of those standards. He never compromised them. He made sure that you lived up to the standards that he was setting. And that was, of course, at the time, that was sometimes painful. Only in retrospect, I realized later, wow, what he gave me. He didn't let you buy by doing something not very excellently. And so he was on you, if you will, all day long. He said, do you think this is excellence? If the fork could have been the slightest bit not straight, hypothetically, he would have said, do you think this is excellence? Do you think standing there with your hands in the pocket is excellence? He said, in the morning, he said, go back and create excellence with your hair. You went home. Okay. So excellence was alive in every activity of the day. So that is what he brought in. In fact, when I left there finally.
But he didn't just talk excellence. He also demonstrated in all that he did. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned is you observing him and the way he interacted with guests.
Yes. Well, I watched – it's one of those days I happened to be in – once a week, typical German upbringing, once a week I go to hotel school. All the kids from the area come to hotel school once a week.
Mm-hmm.
That's typical. And then you go back to work. And I was in hotel school that day, and we were asked to write an essay, what we now, after 2 years working there, what we now think about our industry. I went back to work, and literally what I tell you, I can't explain it, but literally I was cleaning a table all the way back in the corner when I felt that he just came into the room. Wow. I had my back to the door. You just knew it. There was something there that I cannot explain even around him. And
he carried the spirit of excellence and presence. Yeah,
it's amazing. He approached the table, and I recognized something I recognized before, but never internalized it, and never that the people on the table that he approached, those important ladies and gentlemen. Mind you, we were told we're here to serve, and they are very important ladies and gentlemen. But he approached his table, and I realized the guests on those table were proud that he came to them. They were proud that he came. Or they looked up, oh, yeah, Herr Zeitler is here. and he talked to them about food, explained wine for a moment, and he went on the next table, and I realized everybody is proud. And everybody thinks he's the most important person in the room, the guest and we, the employees. And when I contemplated that and I decided to write my essay around him, when I contemplated what happened there is I recognized for the first time, and it was so important recognition, that he had defined himself as a very fine person. That's why they were proud. And I thought to myself, wow, I can define myself. I'm responsible to define myself, not anybody else. Nobody defined him. He is defining himself. And I wrote an essay around it that we all are not servants, but that we are ladies and gentlemen, serving ladies and gentlemen. Unless we sentence ourselves to be average and consequently be servants. or we define ourselves as very fine ladies and gentlemen whose profession it is to serve. And I wrote that essay. And by the way, I made that the motto of Ritz-Carlton when I started Ritz-Carlton.
I know.
And said, we are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. That
for
was the
reason,
essay.
Some reason, I'll tell you, it had even a bigger impact on me when I saw a dominant Herren, you know, im Dienst. Zu Damen Herren, okay? And I saw that, and I said, I did spend some time in West Germany, okay? And I used to speak fluent German, but that was many, many years ago, and I lost it all. But when I saw that, I don't know, it had a big impact on me that you tell a story of, what am I going to write? I have to write this essay, and then this Herr Zeitler comes to mind, and you spoke about how, because we could come across as saying, well, we're just servants, like the general manager told you. Well, you're just a servant. Never forget that, right?
Yeah.
And but Zeitler, he was different. He had great respect for the people he served. He never forgot he was serving, but they also had great respect for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
that's so powerful.
That's what I mean. He created, and he defined himself, I am a fine gentleman, and everybody knew it, you know.
He would say that?
No, he wouldn't say that, but that's how he defined himself in his behavior and everything he did, you know.
Did he ever say that to you as sort of someone he was mentoring or managing? Did he ever say that to you, that how you should carry yourself, or you sort of intuited this, you see?
Oh, yeah, look. He constantly had excellence. He used the word excellence in English, by the way. Excellent. He spoke five languages fluent.
He always said excellence.
Excellence was the word that he used. Okay. Mm. Excellence. And everything, do it with, and now we're going to serve these people. We're saying line. We had a lineup, and he said, now here's a little group. We're going to serve together. Now we're going to do it with excellence. And boom, with excellence, you know, and then you explain what we're going to do it, and then you're going to do this with excellence. Do you understand excellence? Look me in the eyes.
I love where you say that every time that he would look at you and say, is this excellence, right? Or whatever the circumstance was.
And if something was not right, he called you and said, now you tell me how that is excellence. Did I ask that it should be done with excellence? Do you define this with excellence? Okay, no, okay. Yes, sir, yes, sir.
So here you are, 16 years old, and you come up with the motto, if you will, the operating motto for a methodology you're going to develop and use for the rest of your life.
I didn't know it at the time, though, believe me. Yeah,
you didn't,
I tell you what happened, no kidding. It may have slipped away from me, but so I delivered my essay. And then the following week, coming back to school again, the class was full of all the teachers of the school. Everybody was there. And the teacher got up, and we all sitting down, and said, I'm going to read something to you. And he read my essay.
Oh, my goodness. You must have been in shock.
I was in shock. And it was, and I got an end. Here's the key. I got an A, which I never had before. Never. So it impacted me. So it was part of the motto of my life. I lost it for a while. And let me just cut that on here. So I left there. The last thing he did is when I left after 3.5 years and went as an assistant waiter to a hotel in southern Germany. And then I went to Switzerland and Holland America Line, back to Switzerland, from there to France. From there to England, and then I came to the United States. Before I left, he said, look in the eyes. Never. He said, promise me you never will go to work. Always go to work to be part of excellence and create excellence. And I looked him in the eye and said, I will. Now, fast forward. I'm working as a room service waiter in San Francisco, in the Hilton, in the Tenderloin District. And I had a room in the Tenderloin District, a little furnished room where I lived. And I worked as a room service waiter. And my intent was, I will be promoted here to room service supervisor, and then I will go back to the United to Europe for my career. There were four room service supervisor and a room service manager. And I knew I would get promoted because I knew I was by far the best waiter there. I knew everything. I had learned from the very best in the finest hotels in the world. The rest of them just took orders and delivered food. Mm-hmm. But I knew. And the room service manager was German. So the next promotion was me. No question about it. And a few months later, sure enough, one of the room service waiters got promoted. And I didn't get a job.
Wow.
Which was devastating. Ego, everything was hurt. Stupidity of management was clear to me there in that decision.
How old were you at that time?
24.
24, okay.
Yeah. It was absolutely devastating.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a few months to admit the other guy deserved it more.
Wow.
And here's what happened. I was very young, 24. I was in San Francisco. I partied a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good time in the evening. And in the morning at 6 o'clock, when I walked in, you could see from 100 meters that I was tired.
Mm.
And I came a few minutes late. No big deal. Come on, few minutes. No big deal. And when the manager said, do some side work over here, folding napkins or whatever. Why me? Why not the other guys? The guy that got the promotion was always in time. He smiled and said, I'm happy to. Good morning, everybody. I'm happy to fold napkins. And I realized I went to work to work. I went and I came to that realization.
So you broke your promise to Herr Zeitler.
That's it. I went to my little room, ugly little room, and I talked to the maitre d'. Now, he had passed away and he didn't show up. Don't misunderstand me, but I had a long conversation with him and I told him, I apologize, I told him. I went to work to work. And I promise you, it will never, ever happen again in my life. In my life.
This is the San Francisco maitre d' you were talking
about. No. I'm talking to my old maitre d'.
Oh, you called Herr Zeitler?
No. He was dead. He was dead. I just thought I'd talk to him anyway.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now I understand.
I said, I promised you. I would go to work for excellence, and I went to work for work, and it would never happen again.
Mm.
I, what happened to me? And I apologized, and I said, I will create processes to make sure I will never forget it again. My first process simply was to write on the mirror where I shave in the morning, go to work for excellence. And from
there,
you
write that on the mirror?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I wouldn't forget it. So I wouldn't slip into the world, into the stuff in the world. I let myself be slipping in the world, just like I do spiritually. I did it in that case. And I promised I would never do it again. And my career took off like a rocket ship.
Well, when you did, let me just weird, because I think this is important to some of these entrepreneurs. So how did you go from just this high admiration of Herr Zeitler, promising him this at 16, 17, I'm not sure when you left that hotel to start doing 18. Your tour of Europe and Holland, America, 18, you know, yeah. Now here you are 6 years later, and it's sort of somehow you lost that, right? The world had taken over. What happened that that it just sort of slipped away from you and you became, in effect, mediocre, if you will? You know, you weren't practicing excellence anymore.
That's right. That's exactly it. Well, nothing energized it anymore. Nothing energized it anymore. One sleep after the other, more being part of going out with a gang, going out for drinks in the evening, than thinking about my job in the morning. More being part of all of a sudden complaining about the job, complaining about the boss, finding what is wrong because of. In my analysis, I try to analyze that. It was my insecurities took over. Just in case I don't make it, I will be part of complaining about the boss. So in case I don't make it somehow, I have already made the, I have already explained why, because of him.
It wasn't your fault.
Yeah. Without even facing the problem, I took care of the excuses already. I made excuses, and I find that, and I see that with many, many people, many managers. I give you an idea what I mean. Later, when I was running operations for Hyatt, I visited a hotel, and the manager picks you up, and I ask him, "What will you do with? What's your vision for your hotel? What's your vision?" He didn't give me a vision, but he gave me excuses. He said, "You know, Horst, if I had a bigger ballroom, if my restaurant wouldn't be on the second floor, if my hotel would be in a different location, if excuses without giving you a vision."
Yeah.
Just think about it. He made excuses about a vision that he didn't even have.
Right. It was interesting that he was making excuses for a vision that he knows he should have had.
Exactly. And that's where I was. And that's where I slipped into as a young man.
Yeah.
And it was more important to party than to be in time.
So then when that other young man got promoted, okay, that was the room service waiter.
Yeah.
That was a defining point in your life.
Oh, sure.
You could have fell victim to the excuses and the unfairness and justice of it all, but instead you became self-reflective. Tell me what the process was that you went through, because I know you were mad when you first didn't get it.
I thought that was stupidity by management.
Yeah.
It took me a few months to see him, and I couldn't ignore that he was totally reliably being there. I couldn't ignore that he was, when I came to work, that he already was there in the morning. I couldn't ignore that he was laughing in the morning and I was tired, was miserable. I couldn't ignore when I said morning and they said, "How are you?" I said, "Well, tired." And "How are you?" "Fantastic." In return, I couldn't ignore that. And I had to start reflecting on it. Now it took a while because of my ego and my insecurities. It took a while. But once I admitted it, I hit it right on. And it is.
You know, I see this, by the way, I've heard this story with a number of leaders like yourself, okay? There was this defining moment and where they have to say, you know, am I going to complain? Like I hear from people in the past, I've heard from young people that like with my son, he had his friends and this boy was working. I'll never forget this. This just happened about 5 years ago. He was working at Best Buy. And he said, I said, "How's your work going?" And he said, "I work hard and no one else works hard. You know, they're doing this, so I'm not going to work hard anymore." And I said, "Why do you care what they do? Why don't you do the best that you can do?" Because he said, "Because it's just not fair." Okay.
I answer all the time.
And you know what happened to that young man? He wound up dropping out of college and he wound up becoming a delivery driver. And as opposed to other people like yourself that I've heard of and myself, I had the same thing, is this where I said, I just need to forget about them. I need to do the best job that I can do. Okay. Yeah. I need to shine. Okay. That's where success starts, like you said. Okay.
And I realized that actually when I was 16, but I kind of dismissed it. When I wrote that essay, I realized, my goodness, I define myself, not others.
Right.
In a work scenario, I'm defining myself, but I'm also helping to define the organization. And I am defined by my organization. Mm. Give you an example. I went to a speech. I didn't make a speech. I went to the awards for the best hoteliers in the world. Forbes magazine does that. I was a guest there, and all the best hoteliers of the world are there. There are 400 people in the room, and the Forbes guy got up for a speech and said, "Before I go on with my presentation, Horst Schulze is in the room," and they all got up and applauded. Now, let Now, wait a second. Did they applaud me? No, they applauded the reputation of Ritz-Carlton and Capella. But I'm defined by it. I defined it. I helped to define it, but it defines me.
Yeah.
At the same time. But how would that apply to any worker? Well, if the maid, the Ritz-Carlton maid today, looks for a job, and the 100 others, she would get the job because she is defined by the reputation of Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah.
And who defined that reputation? Well, the maids and myself and everybody. So we have to understand that it's not just work. It's and it's stupid things people say, well, this is work and this is private. I'm a different. Wait a minute, you're the same human being, buddy. If you're at work or you so why do you waste your time just working? Why not be there and define yourself as a person of excellence at the same time?
Right. And by the way, how hard and how much harder is it? Like when you went from, you made this decision, right? After this guy gets promoted, you finally look at yourself straight in the eye, right on the mirror, practice excellence. I promised here Zeitler excellence. I'm going to practice excellence. So this is recommitment that you make. How much harder was it? How much more hours? How much more work? How much more? What was it? What was the difference between Horst as this sort of come in late kind of guy, you know, just getting by, doing what he had to do, versus Horst who was practicing excellence?
It was much easier.
Oh, my God. Explain that. What do you mean?
I made it a point to go into work and say friendly hello to everybody. And suddenly everybody was friendly with me.
Mm.
I went in 5 minutes early, and I didn't have a bad conscience as I walked in. I felt good walking in, and so on. It enhanced my life dramatically, period.
Showing up 5 minutes early as opposed to 5 minutes late with no guilt and being friendly to people because you weren't hungover or you weren't tired or you weren't, right? Isn't that something? It doesn't take. It's amazing how little it takes to become the top of your field.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, the difference between excellence and mediocrity is just a little bit more, right?
Well, if I may hit that word excellence, because, you know, I write a book about it, talk about it, use the word about it, and I define
it. I love that. I love now that I know it's not even your word. It's Herr Zeitler's word.
Yeah, that's right. And I studied the word. What does it really mean? Where is it? Where can I improve the pieces? So I came to the conclusion that excellence in a thing, anything is if it works well for which it has been created. It's an excellent item. But in a human being, it is more complex. In a human being, it is simply doing your very best. You're not perfect, but you're doing your very best in your functioning of every in the day. Number two, doing your very best in your relationships every day. Number three, doing your very best morally and ethically. And number four, doing your very best spiritually. Now, after I defined that, I said I have to improve in each one of those aspects.
Where did those four criteria or practices of excellence, where did they come from?
There's no perfection yet. It comes from me. I don't just think about it. If you break it down into your life, what is your life? It's functioning. It's relationships. It is your morality and your integrity, and it's your spirituality. It fills everything you are. So, but if I then question myself, how do I improve those things?
Yeah.
I can't stand still in life. Continuous improvement to me is a very important word in everything. But continuous improvement in a business or in your functioning or in your business is to question yourself, what have you done? How could you do it better? You may have to question yourself once in a while. How could I do better in my functioning? But then again, you have to question yourself, how could I do better in my relationship? Well, I can make sure that I say friendly hello to everybody. If I pass somebody, I can question myself, how could I have done that better? Mm. If I have a sales meeting or any meeting, I can afterwards say, how could I have this? That is relationship, because a meeting is relationship. How could I have done that better? You know, if I'm a salesman, I would ask myself every meeting, how could I have done that better? I would become the best salesperson in the world. Because, in a meeting, if I say one word too many, I'm obnoxious. If I say one word too little, I didn't seem to care. So I have to done that right. Now, next, I have to do this morally and spiritual and so on. And now I have to go to my spiritual. Now here is what it really works. How am I going to bring my spiritual in there? Well, in every function that is of any importance, I have to ask, would God approve? Mm. Bang. Now I'm moving my spiritual into my daily life.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then I have to question myself in my relationships, would God approve? I move my spiritual and to me, to work on those things, if I can, I should ask myself at least once a day, how could I have this relationship better? Once a day. Hmm. And now I'm learning to truly do the most. And relationship is service. And a company, and here's an interesting study recently made. Very interesting study. It's quite recent. 70% of the overall market says, 70%, I would buy my product from you even if I could get the same product for less money next door. I buy it from you if you give me good service. That means relationship.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't I improve consequently my ongoing relationship? If I know my company, people will become loyal to my product, and people are not loyal to a product. People are loyal to people. And that's create a better relationship. So why wouldn't I bring God into that equation? Why wouldn't I say, Lord, how could I have done this better?
And would God approve? I mean, that's a pretty high standard of that, right?
Well, in fact, I believe as leaders, and you entrepreneurs said they're leaders, they're leading something. I have to question myself. First of all, I have to have a vision. I have to have purpose. And then I have to, if I have a vision as a leader, then I have to question myself, is this good for the investors, for the customer, for the employee, for society, and would God approve? It has to be good for all concerned. Otherwise, it shouldn't be your vision. Otherwise, you have to change. But your vision has to be high intent. But otherwise, high intent again creates excellence.
Right.
Coming back to that. But if I have high intent for something, and this is really high, this is how I want to accomplish this particular situation, then I have to ask myself, is it good for all concerned? And would God approve? If I do that, I will know what to do.
Absolutely. It makes sense. But when, it's interesting when you bring this up, these four criteria or these four characteristics, if you will. It's what's interesting to me is the word you used, do your best, right? It goes all the way back to that talk with Herr Zeitler, okay?
Oh, sure.
To me, yeah. In that he might not have had all these criteria. He hadn't thought through it the way or expresses it the way you expressed it. But when you told me he would come to you as a 14 or 15 year old and say, look at this. Is this excellence? The question is, did you do your best here?
Yeah.
Did you do your best cleaning this floor? Did you do your best cleaning that table? Did you do your best folding those napkins? Did you do your best serving those people? He started this, and you just developed it when you owned it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Now, let me come
what
back to an important moment, because I just realized, for example, we had to wash dishes as busboys. Dishes. So we, and the one thing afterwards, the one period that we had, we washed all the wine glasses and so on. And he comes up and picks some glasses and looks at them.
Okay. Through the light, right?
For sure. Yeah. And he said, look at that. There was this, she saw this tiny, you can hardly see its spot. I said, but it's a very little spot, Mr. Zeidler. He said, that's not, but is it excellence? It would be without that spot. Okay.
You know, it's interesting how he taught you so well. He didn't teach you in a classroom. He taught like Jesus taught, right? He taught through actually showing you. He would hold things. He would put a child next to him when he spoke. You know how Jesus did these things. So you were crystal clear what he was talking about. And Zeidler did the same thing. Look at this. Yeah. He didn't say, you should practice excellence in the way you wash, you know, glasses. No, he showed you. He showed you. And it sticks with you. You can't leave it. You can't forget it. Here, look at how old. How old you are now? How many years ago was that, that he told you, he held up that glass and it still sticks with you?
It will be, next year, it will be 70 years ago.
There you go. And here you are. Here you are, a young man, 70 years ago, watching him look at that water spot on that glass, saying, "Are you crazy?" I think that's fantastic. So, how do you go from when you made this, when you finally did this honest look at yourself back when you're in San Francisco, and you say, "No, I'm going to practice excellent. Herr Zeidler, I apologize to you. I recommit to do this for the rest of my life," right? Where does it go from there as a 24-year-old who is now the room service waiter who didn't get promoted?
Well, that was a very important time. I then sat back and said, what do I really want here? Mm. I want to be promoted so that I have a step toward a career away from being a waiter.
Okay.
Forward movement. And then I sat down, what do I have to do? Number one, I have to be 5 minutes early. I have to do the right attitude and so on. What else do I have to do? And suddenly, I didn't use those words at the time. Suddenly, I developed a purpose, not just a pipe dream. And then I committed myself to that purpose. And I kept focus on it. You have to do this right.
What was the purpose?
My purpose was to be promoted.
That was the purpose. Okay.
I had a high intent now. I had a high intent to be promoted because I'm the best waiter, because I'm recognized as the best waiter, be promoted so I can start working on the next promotion after that. It was high intent. But I also got committed to that intent. It's very important, you know, that you create a purpose. And later, you have to question, is that purpose good for all concerned? At that time, it was only me. I didn't have others affected to it. But even then, I could have said it was good, would be good for the people there, for everybody. And then I decided, what do I have to do? I cannot be late anymore. I cannot be miserable anymore when I come in. I have to be friendly to be. And what do I have to do? I have to be. So I applied the things I have to do at the same time, and kept focus on that. Not be sidetracked anymore on things. Kept focus on it, and that's what I noticed. Most people find some kind of an excuse. They don't, instead of being driven by the vision, by the purpose, they suddenly find an excuse, which I really determined, and I looked at that very careful in my career later, is insecurities. They're finding excuses in case they don't make it. Like this miniature.
So what is the answer? You brought up insecurities. Like you talked about your insecurities. Now we're talking about that. Like what's it, what are those insecurities? Are they founded like early in our life from our backgrounds or what?
Well, it was very much, look, I, as I told you, I dropped out of elementary school.
Yeah.
And I come here and I see I want to be a young manager, yet all the young managers here come from Cornell and the University of Las Vegas. How am I going to compete with them? How am I going to do that?
Because in your spirit or in your heart of hearts, you're thinking, I don't deserve this compared to them, right?
Exactly. You know, yeah. So you have to overcome that. And I knew I had to overcome it. I knew I just have to do my very best in what I am doing, in my very best in my relationships. And of course, be honorable and do the right thing.
Because I have that. I've carried those insecurities with me. And because I'm in this world of technology where you're dealing with people from MIT, you know, from University of Illinois, people from Georgia Tech, people from Stanford, you know, people from Wharton. And I sit and I go like, why me? I mean, I can't carry these people's water. I mean, how can it be me? And that's so, but I mean, you really come down to, I think what you say is just perfect is you say, you don't have those things, Charlie, but you have one thing. You can do your very best.
That's the point. I said, I didn't say you should be perfect. I said, you have to do your very best, but then improve it. Then improve it yourself by saying, could I have done better what I did? I mean, that's not simple. And it's a simple thing. If think about it, if you would really think once a day, how could I finish with my work? How could I have done something a little better and tweak yourself?
Yeah.
Can you imagine how good you're going to be after a while?
One thing that I see that you do, one thing that you've been, as you've been talking, one of the things that I see that you do is you have this continuous discourse with Horst. In other words, Horst is always questioning Horst. Okay.
Yeah.
it isn't out there, you know, the dialogue. In other words, look what he's doing, or look what they're doing, or look, this is, how am I doing? How are my relationships? How am I doing in my job? How am I doing spiritually? Yeah. How am I doing? Could I do better? Did this? You always are asking yourself questions that are constantly moving you forward.
Yeah, it is not different. Let me turn this around into a different way, but it's the same thing. I talked to my managers, and I saw a very good employee there that I thought was a good employee. And so what happened to them? Oh, he said he was not good. He was a this and that, but a this, and then we fired him and so on. And so all of a sudden, that employee was a no good. So I said, wait a minute. What have you done to make them better? First of all, it has nothing to do with that employee. If he actually was not good, that's still your fault. Because you, I said to them, were the dummy that hired him. Why aren't you better in hiring them? And you have to question. So you have to question yourself: how do I avoid hiring this person? Yeah. Number two, you may have trained them wrong. Number three, you may have been the wrong example. Number four, your expectations may have been wrong. It's you. You can't do anything about him. So question yourself where you went wrong.
How did people react to that? These leaders that were working for you, how did they react to something like that?
With me, after a while, nobody ever said that anymore because they knew the lecture they would get from me, so they didn't say it anymore. But in the beginning, yeah.
The other side is if they actually asked that question, you knew immediately. If they started questioning you when you were questioning them, saying, hey, it's really you, not him or her, then if they pushed back, you knew who you were dealing with.
That's right. Exactly. Oh,
saying, why did I promote this guy? Why did I hire this person?
Think about it. When you complain about this bad employee, maybe he was a bad person, But he can't, even he can't help it because maybe he was raised wrong by his mother. But you are the one who hired him.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have hired him then. So what is wrong in your hiring process? What, and you have to question yourself there and tweak that and continuously improve those things. No, you know, in you, in all those things, it doesn't help complaining about them. You have to look at yourself, what you can do. I can't do anything about you. I can help you. I give you the right environment. I can, but that's all what I do.
That makes sense. So what happens with, let's go back for a second to this 24-year-old Horst who wants to be promoted, right? Tell me, when did you get a vision? You obviously achieved that next purpose, which is to get promoted because of where I can see where you are now. It probably happened. Okay. So when did you start getting a vision for moving into management within the hotel business?
Well, it evolved. I became assistant room service manager, and then I was an offer to become a maitre d', an assistant manager in a club. I got an offer from the outside. I went in the club and then that same club kind of moved me to Chicago. I became food and beverage director, and then Hilton came to me and wanted to rehire me as a catering manager.
Oh, okay.
And then a year later, I became assistant food and beverage director. A year later, I became food and beverage director over two hotels. Then Hyatt made me an offer to become food and beverage director in the newest flagship hotel in Chicago. Now, I'll give you an idea what happened with Hyatt. I joined Hyatt as food and beverage director of that hotel in Chicago. A year and a half later, I became rooms director in that hotel. A year later, I became general manager in Pittsburgh. 2.5 years later, I became general manager in a very large Hyatt Regency in Detroit. 2 years later, I became region vice president over 10 hotels.
Wow.
2 years later, I became corporate vice president over 65 hotels.
Well, I want to tell you, Herr Zeitler is proud of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. But you had this meteoric rise in the hotel business.
I made up my mind then. I will never go to work for less than excellence, and I will focus on making this excellent and focus everybody else and work. And I give everybody
this
a vision.
This started with writing practice excellence on the mirror in that crappy little room in San Francisco.
That's right.
Your career started.
And by the way, the room was crappy.
I know. You said that a couple of times. That's why I mentioned it this way. Did you have any mentors? That's something.
Oh, yeah.
Zeitler was a big, big influence in your life. Okay. He never left you to today, 70 years later. Did you have any other mentors along the way that had that level of influence on you?
Yes. And I think that's a key element. I think we all are the result of impacts that we had from others through our life, starting with our parents, of course, obviously. So parents, Zeitler, a guy in Germany that where I was short in between, but who stayed connected to me a long time, an unbelievable gentleman, Otto. And then I came to U.S., I was impacted very heavy. That's kind of a strange thing that I'm going to tell you now. I worked finally in the Hilton in Chicago. I worked as catering manager.
Okay.
So I went to the dishwashing department. Usually the dishwashing department where all the after the banquets is a mess. It's horrible. Can you imagine dishes from 1,000 people come back?
Yeah, they all show up at the same time. It's got to be terrible.
It's always a mess. And I went there one time, and I was there a few months, and it was very tidy, everything. And I see this one young man working. I had never seen anybody work like that. I mean, organized. He was a young Indian man.
Uh-huh.
I asked him, "What's your name?" He said, "Setu." Okay. So a few days later, I said, I'm going to look down what happened. I went down there again. And then I went next day. He wasn't there, and there was a mess. And all of a sudden I learned, this man is unbelievable. His organization is so fabulous. And I have to talk to him. So I got to know him. And I got to listen to him. I got to learn from him. He believed in what he was doing. He was a dishwasher, mind you. So finally, after a few months, I saw a chance to get him a promotion going. There was somebody living in our pantry. He could get that job, which is easier, more money, and a step forward. So I went to him and said, "Sit, dude, let's come and sit down." I said, "I got something for you. I want to thank you for the job that you're doing, and I'm watching you for a long time, and I went to the right people, and you're going to get a promotion." He looked at me. What is that? He said, "Work in the pantry." He said, "I'm sorry, not yet. Wow. I need a few more months to perfect what I'm doing." And what are you talking about? He said, "I know I can do this much better, but I have to learn a little bit more. So please allow me a few more months before I get you do something else with me." I said to, "You don't have to. I want to. Please do not give me promotion. Let me perfect my job." And I thought to myself, I think I want to do excellence in my job. This guy really wants to do excellence in his job. So, of course, I took him on for the next few years and moved him, his career through. I left Hilton and went to Hyatt. I took him with me and so on and moved him forward.
When did he eventually get a vision? Like you said, he didn't know what a promotion. When did he get a vision for, you know, he could be something more than a dishwasher?
Well, his vision was to truly achieve excellence in what he was doing.
Isn't this amazing? Here you are, a catering manager for what, Hilton, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. And your mentor is a dishwasher.
Yeah.
He taught you.
Yeah.
He raised the bar for you. That's a beautiful story.
He truly raised the bar for me. And so, of course, I had a guy that by the name of Colgate Holmes, who was vice president and general manager in Chicago when I was the food and beverage director, rooms director, who was a real example of being a general manager and a leader in a hotel and so on. There were other people that you work with. We all are impacted by the people. Hopefully, we allow the right people to impact us. Hopefully, and again, God is a filter there. We have to ask and the question.
Well, the difference is look who impacted you as a 24-year-old room service waiter, and look who impacted you, who's impacting you later in life, you see?
Yeah.
You could have stayed, allowed those lower-level waiters to impact you versus going back to Herr Zeitler's thought and going like, what am I doing? Who have I become, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Sure.
What was the difficulty? How much challenging was it for you to move from being in a service role directly, okay, to moving to a management role?
Well,
some people struggle with that. You know, that's, you know.
Yeah, well,
I could be the best salesman, but then when I become a sales manager, I'm terrible, right? You know, so how do you move? How do you talk about that? Because it looks like you made those changes or those moves effortlessly, you know?
But remember something I said earlier. I was used to by that time to think about purpose. What do I want to do and how I'm going to do it? And commit myself to it. That was everything I do.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what do I want to, what's my high intent here? But like, let me take the big example that's an easy big example. It's Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah.
Or after it's Capella. By the way, Capella was just voted the best hotel company in the world. And you know, so the philosophy works. And let's face it, when I was running Ritz-Carlton, which is a long time ago, we were always voted number one and number two in the world. And then I started Credit Ritz-Carlton Capella, which I sold 2 years ago, but it was just voted best hotel company in the world. And the Capella in Bali was voted best hotel in the world. So that was all my vision. When I started Ritz-Carlton, my vision was I'm going to create the finest hotel company in the world. That's my purpose. That's why I'm going to take the job from Hyatt, where I had my golden handcuffs and everything. And I came here to start to work with a company that had no hotels, but had two hotels in construction and wanted to create a new hotel company. I came here only because they told me operationally I can do what I want. I said, I want to create a hotel company. Best hotel. Go ahead and do it. And then I hired people to join my vision.
Purpose. This is the Capella? Capella or is this Ritz?
Ritz.
With Capella. Okay.
With Capella, I did the same thing. I came
tell
here
me the Ritz story, because this is some of the things that I'm – because Ritz already – did they exist already when you took them over?
No.
They did not?
No.
There was no hotels?
No.
I didn't know that.
No.
So who hired you? And what did they hire you to do?
To become – they that was a developer and money people. They had – two hotels in construction, one to become a Holiday Inn and one to become a Marriott here in Atlanta.
Okay.
The one in Buckhead was supposed to be a Holiday Inn, a Holiday Inn, and the one downtown in Marriott.
Okay.
They couldn't come to agreement with the building was going on already. They couldn't come to agreement with those two companies about the contract. So somebody said, why don't you create your own?
So these are the management contracts is what we're talking about, just to be clear for people who don't know your business, okay?
Yeah. So they said, why don't you start your own hotel company? He said, well, that's not our business. Well, hire somebody. So, well, we don't really know. He said, I can recommend you somebody. Hire this guy from Hyatt. So they called me. I said, I have no interest. You must be kidding me. I'm in charge of 65 hotels. I'm a star in the company. I have my golden handcuffs. I love Chicago. I wouldn't dream to move to Atlanta. Why would I do that? And they said, well, you were recommended. I said, no interest. Thank you very much. I went on working. A few days later, they called me again. As I found out, somebody else recommended me. And they said, hey, this is too much of a coincidence. We better get this guy. So I said to them, look, it's very simple. I'm not interested. He said, well, and then I asked some silly questions like what do you want to do with that company? They said, well, that would be up to you. I said, well, okay. And so, and I said, fine, I'm not interested. Understand, I'm not interested. So I talked to my wife afterwards and said, you know, it would be up to me. Here's what I would do if I would take that job. I would make this a finest hotel, blah, 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 blah. And she said, you seem to be interested.
I love how God talks through our wives. This is how it happens, too.
No, I'm not. I said, I'm not interested. I told him not to call me anymore. And he said, and then I went on again, told her what I would do. And she said, we better pray. And I said, please, honey, okay. She said, I'm going to pray that doors will open, doors will close, and that you will have and do what is right for you and what God wants us to do. Now, I had told them, don't call me anymore.
How old were you at this time?
38.
38 years old, running 65 hotels for Hyatt.
Yeah, 65 for food and beverage operations.
Oh, that's incredible. Okay.
So, say I got to work and something happened that was ethically, I couldn't handle. And I came home and said to my wife, something terribly happened here. I mean, how can I work with this person? I don't know how I'm going to do that. I don't know. And the telephone rings and they called me again from Atlanta. And they said something, we don't want to bother you, but something unusual happened. We got another recommendation on you. Coincidences. God. And he said, and I had in mind, and he said, why don't we at least talk? Can we at least talk? And I said, okay, let's talk.
Wow.
And then I
you know what's interesting in that change that took place, and this is something that happened to me in my life, is when we get to our sort of 30s, and particularly towards our late 30s, close to 40, we start to get comfortable on who we are and what we stand for. Up until that time, we're being molded. We're looking at somebody and saying, is that right? Sure. Or is this right? Right? We're just sort of getting our values straight. Then you, at 38, you see something happen within Hyatt and you go, wait a minute. I either have to compromise who I am to stay here, right?
Exactly.
Or I have to, and just then it's all about the money. Now I just been bought out, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of depression comes from in people's lives, is they're compromising who they are to work where they are because the money owns them.
Yeah. So I accepted my job in August 82.
Yeah.
I gave a 6 months notice, but they said 3 months would be fine. I ended. I came here in January 1983, and in January 84, we opened our first hotel.
Which one was that? Was it in Buckhead or downtown?
Buckhead.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was it called?
Well, okay. In the meantime, we called it. We had several names. We looked for royalty and so on. Several names we were working on. When the owner came to the owners came to me and said, the Ritz-Carlton in Boston is for sale. Why don't we get that? That's a registered name. We can get that and so on. So I talked to my marketing people. They said, you must be crazy. That is a dilapidated, terrible place. We don't want to use that. That hurts us. That takes us. We have to dig out of a hole here. That's a horrible place. So I went to the owner and said, there is another hotel for sale, the Mark Hopkins in San Francisco. That would be much better.
It's a great hotel.
He made an offer, and we would have done that. He made an offer. They accepted the offer, except Intercontinental, who were running it, exercised their first refusal.
First right.
We already had architects looking at anything. So the owners came to me and said, okay, we are going to buy that thing in Boston. It's a great location, but don't worry. We will close it for renovation and put air conditioning in and everything. There was no air conditioning. There was nothing. So the Borderitz, we adopted the name because it is registered globally, which is very difficult to do. Globally registered. We closed it, but the first hotel that we opened, now we had the name Ritz-Carlton. That was in September. In January, we
this
opened
is
our-
September 84?
83.
83, okay.
In January 84, we opened our first hotel, which was Buckhead, which we now use as Ritz-Carlton. Boston was closed for renovation for 2 years.
Here are these developers. You said that the Buckhead property was going to be a Holiday Inn and that the downtown was going to be Marriott, right? So I am now developing the Buckhead property as the developer, as a Holiday Inn. Now you come on board, that changes construction requirements. How did that come about? Because you're going from here to here.
No. Too worse. That was too late. It was finished. Except interior design. We changed totally the interior design. We upgraded the furnishings, we upgraded the lobby, we put marble in it and so on and so on. And what I did, frankly, I used a lot of mirrors. Now I said, in order to move that high end, we're going to put high tea in the afternoon. We're going to have chamber music once a week in the lobby. We're going to create a gourmet dining room rather than a regular everyday steakhouse. We made it a gourmet dining room. I hired a Michelin chef to put in. So I used the images, but the room was a Holiday Inn room.
Isn't that something? How much different when you came on board and you talked about to redo the that redesign the interiors, right? It hadn't been built out internally, has it yet?
No.
Okay. The finishes weren't there. So what was the difference in budget between that Holiday Inn to what you wound up with?
$20 million.
$20 million. And the total project was how big?
You could never determine that because it was a mixed-use development. It was an offices that are connected, basically, okay. So that was all in one budget. So you couldn't say exactly, but it was about 300 at the time, mind you, that's a long time ago, $350,000 a room.
Oh, that's a measurement. Okay, $350
a room. That's a measurement.
And what was a Holiday Inn room at that time?
That a Holiday Inn room would have been $250,000 a room.
So $100,000 more a room. Wow.
Yeah. But wait a minute. That hotel, because of the size of meeting space and so was more. The finished Holiday Inn as it was planned would have been about $320,000 about.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what happened? So now here you are leaving Hyatt as the catering manager for 65 hotels. And now you have, this is your chance to put your Herr Zeitler mark on a new brand. How do you even get started with that?
Well, yeah, I made up my mind to treat it different. Mind you, now, in the meantime, I had been with major companies. I knew how they were being run. I was part of running them. So the concentration that we had, I realized, was not, and I see all companies doing that wrong. I mean, really wrong, and it is frightening to me. There's constant concentration because that's how we are looked at. The concentration is on the money. So we concentrate on profits, on costs, and so on, and we become very good at manipulating it all and so on. And I said, I'm not concentrating on that. I'm concentrate on the stuff that makes money.
Hmm.
And that is service. And then I said, okay, first of all, I want to determine what is.
So did you learn that from, you learned that from working at Hyatt versus.
I learned that from Carl Zeitler. He never talked about money. He never talked about money. He only talked about being excellent, what they're doing, and the money will come.
But the hotels, when you went into management of hotels, all they talked about was money.
That's right. That's all. So every weekly manager's meeting was, what's the forecast? How many rooms? What's the average rate? What's your labor cost? What's your staffing? What's the cost of goods? That was it. So I had my first staff, we call it a staff meeting. And everybody comes with their numbers. Every manager comes in and sits with their numbers. And I said, I want to talk about our product. I want you to concentrate on the product, what we have to accomplish. Service. Let me explain to you what service is. And I said, that's what we... And I talked the next 2 hours, nothing but service. In the next meeting, they all sit there with their numbers waiting. Now we start. And said, all we're going to talk today is about service, cleanliness, and so on. And then I never talked about money. And then finally, my number two comes to me and host, come on, we have to talk about the numbers here. I said, no, we're not going to talk about numbers. We're going to talk about our product.
And this is at the Ritz we're talking about now? Okay, go ahead.
Sure.
So now you're running your own show. You're going to talk about what you know is important to make you successful.
That's right. That's all. We concentrate what makes us successful. And then we started and said, now I said we have to study the customer more and respond. And because for me to, consequently, here's how I look at a company. Over here is your market. Over here are your employees. The first thing I have to know, if I'm going to be a great company, I have to know what is my market's expectation from my product. What is their expectation from my product? So I went in and bought customer analysis, customer studies, and said, and then I started to make sure, and now I have to make sure that my employees know what is the customer's expectation from us. And that's alignment. Everybody today, if you heard, is a buzzword, alignment. Well, that's alignment. But there is no alignment in companies. Now I have to make sure my employees really know what is the expectation of customers. Now management, here's what management is. Management creates processes, systems, measurements, controls to make sure that it's delivered. What is leadership? Well, leadership creates an environment in which the employees want to do it.
Mm.
Now I have to say, how I'm going to do that? Well, by aligning the employees not only to what the customer wants, but aligning the employees to the company. Who are we? You are part here. You're part of a vision. Here's the vision. Here is how that vision is good for you. Here's how you will benefit if we are the best in the world. You will be respected. You will have opportunities. You will make more money. You will have everything. So aligning them to the customer's expectation and to the company's motive and operation and objectives. Now I have aligned employees and create an environment in which they're part of and not, and from there on, we didn't hire people anymore to come to work. We hired people to join our dream, to become the best in the world. And guess what? And listen, we had 50 hotels in each, when I was running Ritz-Carlton, we were in 5 continents and each hotel was rated number 1 in their market segment. That wasn't coincidence.
Congratulations on that.
And you know, by the way, and I have to say that, and forgive me if I say that, we had hotels in Africa with all black people, and it wasn't different there. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me more about differences here. And I had them in Asia. It wasn't
it's not
different
cultural
there.
Differences, right?
That drives. Yeah, sure, I had to respect the Japanese culture, yeah. But nevertheless, I was the best in Japan. And I was the best in China, and I was the best in Germany, I was the best in the United States. It had nothing to do with race and culture. What a load of dirt it is.
Well, that goes back to your thing of, it's just, if you start pointing to that, it's just an excuse. And that's bad. And that's bad leadership, right? I mean, that's, yeah.
That means we have bad leadership. Talking about, we have to differentiate. You know what I did?
That was like your story. That was like your story that you talked about when you were in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. You know, that whole with Walter, the union organizer guy, you know, and all that, and how you, because that was the worst hotel. Like who would ever think, even the mayor gave you, he couldn't believe you inspired a city by bringing that thing out of the ground.
That's it. In, you know, I didn't concentrate on, allow me to say this, please. I didn't concentrate on if somebody is from Germany or from the United States and have different culture, or put them in a group. I concentrate on them as an individual. I don't concentrate on, I have to treat this group because they are Japanese different. Mm. No, when I dealt with a manager, I had a profile. When we hired, we developed a profile for each employee. I knew who they were. So I helped them individually to grow. Rather than putting them in a group, you're black and you're white and so on. It's stupid. The stupidity of that is outrageous. It's going against God. They're all human beings.
Right. And they're all fully capable. And they all want something. That's another point you make, is that people want better. They want a better for their lives. They have a bigger dream than just grinding out work and then enjoying themselves after work, right? I mean,
exactly. Listen, I opened every Ritz-Carlton and every Capella myself and did training, if it was in Bali or in Shanghai or in Berlin or in Africa or in Frankfurt or in Philadelphia. I opened them. I worked with those people.
That was a question I had, is how do you take those high ideals, high expectation, this principle of excellence, practicing excellence, getting better at everything, better at what you do, How do you then take that into the organization for other leaders so that you can leverage? And you're saying that you actually open these things.
And listen, you read my experience in Jamaica.
I love that story. That story almost brought me to tears, that story, when they the way they should. Tell that story.
I cried there. Don't anybody tell me about racial differences. You liars, you. It's not. If they're all human beings who want to be wonderful, but if you tell them you're different and you're wrong, of course they're going to be different.
So what did they tell you when you were going to open this hotel in Montego Bay, Jamaica? What did they tell you?
They told me all they're terrible here. They're all thieves. They're no good. They're terrible people. You cannot trust them. I was warned by every hotelier, every European hotelier.
Okay.
In Jamaica, when I came there, I said, "Oh, it's going to be different here. You have no idea. Those people, they're nothing but steal. They're nothing but lie, and so on."
So and what
experienced the finest human beings that I've ever want to experience. And I cried. I literally cried about those people, those wonderful human beings.
Well, tell the story a little bit so that people, I mean, I read the book, you wrote the book. I mean, a lot of people haven't heard this story. It's both saying it's a wonderful story. Tell the story.
Yeah, okay. Well, as I said, I went to every hotel.
Yeah.
And helped training and orienting the people and gave them the orientation as to who we are and aligned them to my customers and to us. And the first day I told them, like with everybody, you're not servants here. You are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. That means we respect you as such, but you have to behave as such too. Now, here's who you are, and we look forward to work for you. And my typical, and here's what we think about our customer, all the normal orientation. Mm. The next day I went for a run in the morning early, which I always did every day. And I ran, and as I come running back toward the hotel, I see this beautiful people going to work, going somewhere. And I thought they're probably going to a funeral or for a wedding. They're all dressed so nice. Some have hats on. And I said, wow, I wonder where they're going. And they walk, you know, because they're typically people, they're walking.
Yeah, they don't have cars and all that, right? They're walking.
Many of them are walking. I was saying, wow, and I caught by and they said, hello, friendly, good morning. I said, when you pass somebody, when you come within 10 feet, you say good morning or good afternoon. That's what you do. And they say, good morning. Oh, wow, that is strange stuff what's going on here. And I come closer to the hotel, they're going toward the hotel. They're going toward the employee's entrance. And I realized I had said, you are ladies and gentlemen, you should act and dress and behave like that. They all put their best Sundays on to come to me. I tell you.
So you showed them respect, you gave them an expectation, and they exceeded it.
They exceeded it. And that's why I get so angry about this whole race discussions now. I know this is BS. It's all the same. Respect each other as human beings. God help me. They're all beautiful, created by God, human beings, no matter who they are. Right. But so am I and so are we.
Yeah.
We're all brothers created and sisters created by God. And tell you, I was in 5 continents. There's no difference. there's certain culture stuff that they learned. I mean, I had for each culture where I worked, I had a file in my briefcase. Before I landed, I studied do's and don'ts. Okay, of course, there's certain behavioral things they do or don't in various areas, like if you sit down in many countries in Asia, if you laugh, put a hand in front of your mouth. Big deal.
Right.
I don't change that. No, so what? But deep in the mind, the integrity, the honor, the guts that they want us to care. I heard a speaker the other day. I mean, people talk so stupid. a hotel business speaker. And he spoke before me and said, everything was changing. You have to understand, everything has changed and everything keep on changing, everything.
When was this?
Oh, about two months ago.
Okay, great. This is great. I just want to...
This big speech about everything changes. Nothing changes. You're telling me the guests today doesn't want us to care. They don't want us to respect them. They don't want us to give them the very best. It's all the same. The human being wants to be respected, wants to be cared for, wants to be honored, wants to not be insulted, wants to not be... That's it. Now, how we deliver that, that will change. That will change, but not what they want.
Give me an example of how you deliver that might change.
Oh, delivery will change. For example, if you are staying in my hotel and you tell me that you like chocolate cookies, and the next hotel you come into, you're going to get chocolate cookies because I know it now.
Oh, I see. Because you have that data. Now it's in the computers, all that stuff. I got what you're saying. Yeah.
You can check in on this thing over here. That will change. But the fact that you want me to respect you when you come and that you want your room to be very clean and you want me to respond to you will not change.
You know, it's interesting. I'm just putting together a couple of things. Some of what you talk about in your book about guest expectations, okay, and how you sort of spoke, how you then – you go from customers to employees to leadership, right? So – but when you talked about the guests and employees – something happened to me. I went out to Arizona and I stayed at a family-owned Hampton Inn kind of a deal, right? I get there, check in very late, and I get a rump room. It's not the room that I had said I wanted to be in. It was stuck in the middle. I went out and I complained. And this guy, who is not your Ritz-Carlton dressed-up desk man, you know, desk clerk or whatever, he said to me right off, he said – no, it wasn't him. He was gone. The night clerk said, well, why don't you just stay there? I don't have anywhere else to put you. The head clerk comes in the morning. And I talked to him, and I was like, I'm geared up for a fight, right? Because I'm paying a lot for a room. That's not the room I want to. And I get there, and he said, Mr. Paparelli, he said, this is all my fault that this happened. I shouldn't have done what I did. I did do it. I apologize for it. Here's what I'm going to do to make it right. And I actually came home. Every day we became friends. I was there for about 5 days. When I came home, I wrote a long blog about him and I published it. And then I called the hotel to tell the manager how great this guy is.
That is called excellence in problem resolution. We certified every single employee how to handle problem resolution, a complaint. First of all, you listen. Secondly, you show empathy. Mm. Third, you apologize. Not them, me. I am sorry.
Yeah.
Even if, as I say in my book, even if the guest complains to the busboy in the restaurant about his TV, the busboy is going to say, please forgive me. And then you make amends.
Oh, my goodness. That's great.
And we in fact, certified every employee, 20,000 employees around the world, how to handle complaints. If something goes wrong, because I know how you felt after he apologized very bad. You nearly felt sorry that you complained. Perfect.
Because, I don't know that I'd take it that far. Okay, but I have been in that position. I have been in that position.
Sure, yeah. Because we know, and as business people, we should know that. Everybody who listens should understand that. If a guest complains, if you don't make amends, he becomes a terrorist against your company. And we know that 96% of all complaints, 96%, not in our business, in all businesses, is the guests just want to get rid of their frustration. Accept it. Listen to it. Yeah. Show empathy and apologize. That's all they want. And then in cases where we can make amends, like he did with you, you make amends and you create a loyal customer. I mean,
it is amazing. One of the things you did say is that I think your employees had authority to spend up to $2,000 to satisfy a guest.
That's right.
And you tell every employee. Yeah. And you tell some stories that are unbelievable stories on how some of these employees use that $2,000, and you never tell a story on how they abused the $2,000.
They didn't. Yeah. One day it was never spent $2,000. It was spent one time. And frankly, I disagreed on how it was done, but I didn't tell anybody
okay.
at the time because I had gone around and said, doesn't matter. It was kind of a stupid decision in my opinion, but it created so much PR that it paid off. It was a great
thing. Oh, that was the finding the ring on the beach.
Yeah. No, that was another one. That was good. That was a good one. No, the going to Hawaii with a computer was kind of silly.
Oh, okay.
I never told anybody that. I never.
Okay. I don't know the story, and we don't have to dig into it. We don't need to have negative stories. We only have to have positive stories. That's it.
You know, because it's the only time. But when I came up with this 2000, empower everybody to move heaven and earth to keep a customer that's unhappy. In fact, we empower you to spend up to $2,000 to keep the customer loyal to us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that created a nuclear explosion. Every owner of hotels, now we're a management company, every owner, mismanagement, we're going to sue you. No, and it was the greatest success you can imagine, you know.
And it is amazing how little it takes, though. And to have a customer be happy and to continue to come back. I went to a fairly upscale restaurant yesterday with my wife for an early dinner, and we had a meal, and we were going to order dessert, and the hostess seated some people behind me, some older people that had these women had some very heavy perfumes on. And I'm allergic to perfume. So as soon as they came, I smelled it, immediately got up because I didn't want to have a reaction. And I go and I chase down the waitress and I say, I need to just check out because we were going to order dessert, but I said, these people were here. And I said, I have to get out of here. And so she checked me out. And I was thinking, you know, if this was a really class, and the manager saw me do this, got up and didn't say anything. I said, if this is a classy place, when they brought the check, they would have brought the dessert and given it to me.
Oh, sure.
And they didn't. Now, I've been to that restaurant a lot, and I'm thinking, maybe I'll go to another restaurant another time instead of having to deal with that. He didn't seem to think, he didn't care about me as a customer, you know?
Yeah, well, by the way, in our certification of a problem resolution, we say one more word that I didn't add here because I didn't want to explain it. Listen careful. Number two, show empathy. Number three, apologize. Number four, make amends, like move you to another room. But number five, delight them. Meaning, in that case, after you did it, send some cookies, give them, do something. Show them, hey. And you will immediately move a customer from satisfied to being loyal to you.
And that's where they missed.
And that's where you want them to be.
She brought the check quickly. She tried to accommodate me, but there was no delight side.
That's right.
Really very, very good. That is very, very good. So how do you get this? I see where you're opening each hotel, and we're kind of winding down here a bit. I know because you've got another meeting, but you get to these other hotels, you were the one opening the hotel. So the CEO who has – how many hotels were in the Ritz?
We had 50 and been left,
50 hotels. You're still opening hotels. You're doing the orientations for these employees and all that. How do you make sure how do you know if you're going to have a leader, that general manager of that hotel, is going to represent you and your ideals each and every moment of each and every day? Because that's who you are. You are Herr Zeitler's emissary here, okay?
Well, you of course, it's all process-driven too. You have to
Oh, is it? Okay.
Oh, yeah. You cannot hope that it happen. You cannot just treat it. You have to measure it and so on. First of all, we were very careful in selecting our employees. We our managers went through very rigorous analysis, and we had a outside company analyze their philosophy about everything. So we knew we were probably better than anybody else in our business in hiring people. Then we had a very, very rigorous orientation. We didn't teach function. We only taught who is who we are, join in these objectives, and so on. And then we taught very careful. And then we kept on teaching. We teach one point, one essential point. Every 20 days, that same point. Now, today is point 11, tomorrow 12. Now, in 4 weeks, point 11 will be, in 20 days, point 11 will be repeated. For example, point 11 happens to be, I mentioned point 11, if you get a complaint, you own it. Okay. Here's how you handle it. In 20 days, that's being taught again. And the manager is involved in teaching, so the manager automatically takes it in too.
Yeah, it's very reinforcing. They're going through the principles of service. What did you call those?
The 20 basics, our gold standards.
Okay, our gold standards, okay.
And I call them non-negotiables. This has to happen in every Ritz-Carlton hotel. No matter what we say, what we tell me is different in Japan, that has to happen, no matter what. Because they always happen. It's different here. Yeah, yeah, okay. But those 20 things. So that is, and then I measure everything. I actually knew every morning, I knew the customer loyalty that was established month to date, year to date, and that day in every hotel. And if it slipped from a top box, 92%, I want to recommend, I want to come back, top box. If it slipped from 92%, I immediately got involved myself.
Oh, okay.
If it was staying there for 2 months, below 92%, I made it very clear, 4 more weeks, and it's not corrected, I will move into the hotel and correct it myself.
Wow.
With the general manager. You have to understand.
Wow.
Well, let me just, maybe we have to finish, unfortunately, that. I had made it very clear. To be the best hotel company in the world would be good for all concerned.
Yeah.
For the investors, for the guests, for every employee.
Every employee. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
For society, and God would approve.
Huh?
And I had no right to compromise that. I had no right to compromise that. In my opinion, I owned three things. That is, number one, I owned the vision of the company. We want to be the best in the world, and I don't let it go away.
Mm-hmm.
That's our purpose. And the greatest gift I'm giving you is to join a purpose rather than just work. Number two, I own the standards. I will not compromise the standards. Number three, I will not delegate. I will not delegate that some customers are jerks. I'm the only one who can make that decision, nobody else. Because they want to say, oh, here's what happened, but he was an idiot. You cannot make that decision. I make that decision. Nobody can make that decision, only I.
And those are the three things that you owned as the CEO.
Totally.
That's fabulous.
I measured four things every day: the economics of the day, the future indicators, business indicators, of course.
Yeah.
The customer satisfaction, the will not return, and the meeting planner's satisfaction, the individual customer meeting plan. Right. That's I own. I looked at every day. And the employee's satisfaction.
That's fabulous. And where did those all. and those surveys were done internally?
No. And we had an outside company do that.
Outside company did that. That's how you have to do to maintain the integrity of them. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's okay. Fabulous. This was great. This was really enjoyable. I have other questions, but we don't have time. But
Let's do one of the things
that I'll tell you that really stuck with me from your book, and we've talked a number of times about it, and we're saying it came from Herr Zeitler. I think Herr Zeitler has become a part of me now, having had this conversation and read this book. His legacy lives on. Yeah. But it was, I don't focus on the money. I focus on the things that make us the money.
That's right.
Right? And that is such a simple principle, but so profound and can change everything. And if I would have known that, it would have actually changed my career in some businesses that I were in, that I was very unhappy in because all we did was measure stuff. Okay.
Yeah. I said one of my assistants came to me and said, Hosh, we better go through the numbers. And I said, no, he couldn't. He was somebody who was so used to it. And I know. I'm getting a message that I have my next call. But anyway, he was so used to looking at the numbers for so many years. He couldn't over. It was going against his. That was who he was. But it took a while. He became also. He got away from that, but he came to me. We can't do that. We have to go to numbers. They're not paying attention to. Maybe they're not paying attention to numbers. I said, I want them to pay attention to what makes the numbers. I will talk. I have to, because I knew I had to change the attitude, the thinking, the modus operandi of the company. I had to change, and nobody was used to that. That's all I talked about. Now, after 6 months, I mixed it. But for 6 months, that was against my. I wanted to talk about the numbers.
Yeah.
I talked to financial people about the numbers, and I told them to talk about it, but I didn't talk about it.
Yeah. I'm with you. Well, okay. I thank you so much for this. I'm going to just say goodbye and to the audience, and then I'll come by, say goodbye to you. Take me 10 seconds, okay? And then we'll be on our way. Thanks for joining me and Horst on the Paparelli, Charlie Paparelli Show. I'll tell you, as a business person or as a leader, don't focus on the money. Focus on the things that make you the money, and then the money will follow. So thank you very much for joining us. And you have a good day. Remember, sign up at paparelli.com. Thank you.